This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Every once in a while, we share some reading tips with you, and today we'll do it again with a compendium of books for you and your children for late summer, early fall reading. That's later in the program. But actually, you might want to add this book to your list, White House Story, a Democratic memoir. It's by our guest in this part of the program, Melinda Bates. During the Clinton administration, she was special assistant to the president and director of the White House Visitors Office. The White House, as you might imagine, gets lots of visitors, but she says the hardest part of that job is pulling off the annual Easter egg roll. If you can do that, you can do anything. And that's just one piece of information that she shares in her book. Melinda Bates, welcome to Charlotte and to Charlotte Talks. Nice to have you here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you, Mike. And good morning, Charlotte.
Good morning. Melinda is actually here, not to be on this program, but to appear at the Southern Women's Show Friday and Saturday at the Charlotte Convention Center. That's a new location for the show this year for those of you who go back year after year. I think this is the 37th year for it. I'm curious about the title of your book, White House Story, a Democratic Memoir. And I know you worked in the Clinton administration. Is that what makes it Democratic, or is it because it's the people's house?
Both. How nice of you to pick up on that. It's both. Actually, the book has been issued twice, and the first time it was published, my title, which I just loved, was Clintonista, a title I was very proud of. But
that was a pejorative title.
It was. Well, we took a note from the Republican playbook in which we took something that was perceived as a negative and adopted it as a positive. So I'm very proud to be a Clintonista.
You know, it's interesting. You and we're going to talk about how you got the job and all that good stuff, but before you got the job, I believe you had lunch with several people from Republican administrations your job.
Well, they had jobs in the White House. They had worked for President Reagan, and these ladies were just lovely to me. They took me to lunch in one of Washington's most fabulous restaurants and talked to me about the fact that I had essentially found out about this job, claimed this job in my heart. It had become my job. Mm-hmm. And they were talking to me about what it's like to work for a president and a first lady and so forth. And it was not until the end of that luncheon that one of them gently asked me if I had any reason to believe that I was actually going to get this specific job. Very tactful of them. And I remember saying to them in all earnestness, I do. I know this is my job. I cannot explain it to you in any way that would make rational sense. All I can tell you is I know this is my job. And in the end, it was.
You write in the book that when you said that to them, they kind of looked at each other with this knowing glance. What did that glance mean? She's crazy? Or we had that same feeling, too.
I think it was that they recognized that this is how some things happen in life, that a door opens, and if you're paying attention, you recognize that a door is open in front of you, and you claim that opportunity and walk through.
You know, when the Clintons took office, there was a lot of political unrest about them throughout their administration, and before it, because right after his election, even while he was running, I kept hearing on the radio from people who had all these outlandish stories about him as the Arkansas governor and about things that had gone on in Arkansas. And I talked to people with the Arkansas Democrat newspaper. They were really out to get him. And I just never understood the animosity going in. But you met with these Republican women from previous administrations, from the Reagan administration, and they were delightful to you.
They were lovely.
Is that because you were on the cusp of a sea change in American politics? Because since the Clintons, we've become very polarized. Is that why? Because you were... It hadn't happened yet?
If you're asking if I think that would happen today, I think it's very unlikely that that would happen today. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a camaraderie of people who have served in an administration who understand, as no one else can, the stresses, the enormously long hours, the difficulties, the strains on people's marriages and relationships, and the desperate need to get everything 100% right 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So there is kind of a brotherhood and sisterhood of people who have shared that experience. So I was very kind to people who had served in previous administrations. And I remember once a man who had been an ambassador for President George Herbert Walker Bush, for whom I had done a number of favors when I was in office. And he once asked me, why are you doing this for me? It's wonderful that you are, but you don't owe me anything. And I'm a Republican. I'm from a previous administration. Why are you so kind to me? And I said, well, because I have friends who are ambassadors, and I know the sacrifices that people make and what the toll it takes on families and how difficult it all is. And I honor your public service. I think of this as a challenge and an honor to serve the public. And so that's my motivation.
less people think that all these jobs go to are impossible to get. You worked at Macy's prior to getting this job. Nothing wrong with working for Macy's, mind you, but you worked at Macy's. You weren't a muckety-muck in the government.
No. I actually started my career as a church volunteer. That's how I got started. I went from church volunteer to special assistant to the president with a fabulous office in the East Wing of the White House. And I started by doing things that I thought of as hospitality and which I later learned were meeting planning. Mm-hmm. Who knew there was an actual career doing something that I loved to do and was good at? So I was doing that for church groups that came to Washington for 3 or 4 day seminars or maybe a week and needed local people to put on events, to host receptions, to organize volunteers and so forth. From that, I went to a job at the National Gallery of Art, which I just adored, working at special exhibitions. And I well remember when I left that job in 1989, it was time to leave because there were no more special exhibits at the time for me to work on. And I remember sitting in my car and thinking to myself, well, I have loved this job. It's clearly the best job I will ever have in my life, because where else could I, a perfectly ordinary person, work in such beautiful physical surroundings with such intelligent and interesting people, and where there's a stream of amazing celebrities coming through every day, the most astonishing people to talk to? I mean, this has been the highlight of my career life. Ha ha. Because, of course, I then ended up working at the White House in the most amazing and beautiful physical surroundings.
You write about, and we'll talk about how you knew the president prior to his election, but you write about when he was elected, you went to a library and you checked out the Plum Book.
The Plum Book.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Well, it's a sort of a Washington insider thing, the Plum Book. It's a call that in Washington because it lists all of the jobs that an incoming president gets to fill in a new administration. So these are plum jobs.
Right. And is it a physical book called the Plum Book?
Well, I forget what the official title is. Okay. It's not called that, but everybody in Washington calls it the Plum Book.
Wow. You say that getting this job was the most, outside of having children, was the most exciting day of your life.
It was absolutely, because I had I'd like to go back for a minute and explain that I had never once during the campaign where I worked as a volunteer ever thought there might be a job for me at the end of it, because I assumed, as I think many Americans do, that surely everybody who works at the White House must be a foreign or domestic policy expert or a numbers cruncher or certainly an attorney, and I am not any of those things, so it just didn't occur to me. And then the night of the election, we were just over the moon. Our friend had won. It was sort of hard to believe that someone I'd known since we were 18 was now going to be president. And the next morning I woke up and for the very first time thought, gosh, I have loved working for candidate Clinton. I wonder if there's something I could do for President Clinton, but what could that be? So that's what took me to the library and took me to the Plum Book, where I found a page that listed the executive office of the president and 10 jobs, the name of the person in the job and the phone number. And one of those jobs was director, White House Visitor's Office, Miss Janet Johnson, and a phone number.
And you toyed with the idea of calling Janet Johnson, but you thought, no, I don't. This is an outgoing administration. It was a one-term presidency.
I didn't want to hurt her feelings.
Exactly right. And you want to talk about things that just fall into place. You were
really
working at Macy's. Talk about this.
Well, I was working at Macy's doing special events. And so I saw this page in the book, and I, as you say, I wanted to call this lady and ask her, what does the White House Visitor's Office do? Is it similar to the work I had done on exhibitions at the National Gallery of Art? And obviously the easiest way to find out would be to call this woman and ask her. But just the night before, her boss, President Bush, had been pushed out of office by the American people. So he was going to leave, and she would be leaving what I assumed was the most exciting and interesting job of her life. And it just seemed to me that if I called her, I would be so mean. It would just be unkind to do that. And I thought, well, I'll photocopy this page. I'll take it home and I'll think about it. And the next day I went back to my job at Macy's, and we had advertised for all kinds of special events and people had called in. So I was listening to my messages, and you know how you do. You're not really paying attention. Mm-hmm. Just writing down names and phone numbers, call this person, call this person. So I was not paying the least bit of attention. I dialed a number, and this is what I heard on the other end of the phone. White House Visitor's Office. Wait, what? And I looked down at the paper and I said, I'm returning a call from Janet Johnson. And they said, we'll see if the director is available. And the next thing I knew, I was speaking to the director of the White House Visitor's Office. Now, how many phone calls do you think take place in Washington in a day? A billion?
Yeah.
So the universe knew that I was uncomfortable calling her, so it arranged for her to call me.
So what exactly does the White House Visitor's Office Director do?
The primary mission of the Visitor's Office is to interact with the members of Congress for access to White House tours, which any member of Congress will tell you is more important to his or her reelection than any speech they will ever give. They all want their constituents to get in and walk through the White House.
And they don't want to take the regular White House tour. They want
There used to be public tours where people could line up outside and just walk in later in the morning. But those are gone because of security reasons.
Oh.
So everything – but we all always had these reserve tours in the morning, group tours and also individual tours, and never enough capacity to meet the demand. So it's a juggling act. And people, I think, in the West Wing, at least in the beginning, would look over at us in the East Wing and say, well, they just do events and tours. That's not the most important thing to the president's agenda, without realizing that whether a member of the House of Representatives would vote for the president's budget or not would depend on whether I had arranged the tours that person wanted.
There's something else. This was a magical thing for you. The more I read about it, I thought this is all the pieces just fell into place as though they should have, without very much nudging from you. After you talked to Janet Johnson in the Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, she told you what the job was. You applied for it.
I thought, this is the job. This is my job. I am so perfect for this job.
And you heard nothing.
I sent in my friend took 20 copies of my resume to the transition office in Little Rock, put them on every desk, and we sat back and waited. I waited through the rest of November. I waited through December. It's one of the only Christmases in my life I have no recollection of because all I can think about is my job. This is my job. I had the luncheon with those ladies that you mentioned, and I'm thinking, this is my job. Now we come up to Inauguration Day, and I haven't heard. But it's my job. So I went to the inauguration. I watched my friend take the oath of office. The whole city was filled with optimism for the future. We were excited. It was wonderful. But I hadn't heard anything. So there's a picture of me in the book and on my website at going to the inaugural ball that night. And while I do look happy, if you look at my eyes, it kind of looks like my best friend and my dog have died because I'm thinking, why haven't they called me?
And so you're watching, I think you're watching on television. The Clintons opened the White House very much like they used to do in the 18th century, the 19th century, to the public. And they were doing personal little get-togethers with the public. And you watched this on TV, and it was a fiasco.
It did not go well.
And you thought, this would not have happened had I been there. And you're just biting
yourself
in the arm.
My husband actually said to me, why aren't you there? If you were there, this would go really well.
The phone rings.
The phone rings. I answer the phone. Hello? Yes, this is the White House calling. Yes, now I'm calling about the job of director of the visitor's office. I'm literally speechless.
Yeah.
Yes, she said, now have you interviewed for this job? Gosh, no, I haven't. Well, have you spoken to anyone about this job? No, haven't done that either. And then she said, well, it's the strangest thing. I have not been told to interview you. I have been told you are the person for this job, and we need to get you in here right away. And that's how I got my job.
So now we are in the job, and when we come back from the break, we'll talk about what that job really is and some of the highlights and lowlights of that job and many other things with our guest today, Melinda Bates, the author of White House Story, a Democratic memoir. She'll be talking about this more extensively even at the Southern Women's Show this Friday and Saturday. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service. August marks 36 years of Heartwood helping Charlotte trees outlive its humans. Now caring for trees in the Asheville Black Mountain area as well. Info at heartwoodtree.com. CMPD Chief Kerr Putney joins us in the aftermath of the Randall Carrick mistrial, which resulted in only minor protests and a few arrests last weekend. That's tomorrow at 9. But Putney sees that the department's work is far from being over, and there are lots of wounds to heal. He will share his thoughts on community building, on race relations, and repairing some things inside the police department itself tomorrow at 9. And then we get a recap of a busy week in Raleigh with lawmakers grappling with the budget, charter schools, Medicaid, and more. Join us then.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, abortion opponents seek details on women who get abortions and the doctors who perform them. Several states have moved to cut Planned Parenthood funding, even for clinics without abortion services. New tactics in the anti-abortion movement.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Melinda Bates, former special assistant to President Clinton and the director of the White House Visitors Office for the 8 years of the Clinton administration, is our guest today. She's the author of White House Story, a Democratic memoir. You met the president, as you said, when you were both 18 years old. He walked up to you and introduced himself as running for president of the freshman class at Georgetown University. You had never met before.
No, and at the moment I was wandering around the campus dazed, confused, and overwhelmed. It was the first week of freshman year. I didn't know anybody because my family is from D.C. I was a day student, so I didn't have a roommate. I wasn't in a dorm. Where's my next class? Do I have the right books? But most importantly for an 18-year-old, how am I going to make friends here?
Right.
And this tall, skinny kid with a big head of curly hair walked up to me, stuck out his hand, and said, "Hi, I'm Bill Clinton. I'm running for a freshman class president."
You found his accent to be irritating.
I found it astonishing because we didn't hear a lot of that in Washington.
And you said you've always noticed men's hands and that he had beautiful
hands. He has beautiful hands. Yeah.
Really?
He does have beautiful
That's important.
Long fingers.
Is that important?
No, it's not
okay,
important.
Just
something I noticed.
So you say that at some point in that initial conversation with him when you were both 18 years old, that you thought to yourself, this is an extraordinary person. He's going to do amazing and important things with his life, and I hope I get to watch it happen. He's going to make history someday. I have to ask, is that an exaggeration? Did that really go through your mind?
And if so, why? I know it sounds like that, but I speak all over the country, and people come up to me and say they had exactly the same experience because that is what Bill Clinton is like. He's like kind of a supernova of charm, but if it were just the charm alone, that would be kind of vacant. Mm-hmm. And if his charm has all this brilliance and intensity behind it, and if he meets you, he will never forget you, but I assure you, you will never forget him. If he's in the room, he's the only thing that you notice in the room. He's just like that. And so I've never had an experience like that again in my life. Essentially, when we were both 18, I knew he would be president someday.
Wow. And is that why you worked on his campaign, because of that experience, or because you followed him and you...
Well, we remained friends after school, and then in 1988, we were at a Georgetown reunion, and the school had asked Governor Clinton to come and speak about whatever he wanted to speak about. And in those days, we had a president who used to speak from a teleprompter and with note cards and didn't seem to me anyway to be that much in mastery of the issues. And Governor Clinton got up and spoke without a note, spoke from his heart for almost 2 hours about the problems facing America today and how we could leave a better world for our children.
President Obama has been accused and criticized for speaking from a teleprompter, although he's gotten less – he's weaned himself from that over the 8 years.
That.
But I was also at a healthcare summit, for lack of a better term, when Hillary Clinton – introduced her health care plan to members of the media. They invited us up. We went to the White House. She spoke. And she spoke for about 2 hours. It seemed like 2 hours, but it was probably more like an hour. Without note cards, with no teleprompter, completely extemporaneously, and never uttered the word It was as though she were reading it from a prepared script. And it wasn't. It was completely off the cuff. Which just blew me away, because I got to tell you, I do this for a living. I couldn't do it.
Well, they speak from the heart, and they speak about the things that they've been invested in from their earliest days. So it doesn't take notes to do that. Mm. They just That's their delivery. That's just how they are. I have been surprised to see President Obama speak from a teleprompter, even for very brief remarks. I'm kind of puzzled by that myself, because he's a wonderful speaker. He's a great orator. So I'm a little surprised by that. But the Clintons don't do that.
Let's talk about the Easter egg roll, since I've referenced that at the very beginning of this, because you said if you can do the Easter egg roll, you can do anything. That's one of the traditional events at the White House, and I would imagine a lot of events are steeped in tradition and protocol, and you have to do it this way because this is how we've always done it. What is it about the Easter egg roll that makes it so difficult?
The Easter egg roll is the largest, most complex event that takes place at the White House every year. And that quotation about if you can pull off an Easter egg roll, you can do anything, it's actually not from me. Mm-hmm. It's from an outgoing George Herbert Walker Bush person who was working on the transition with the Clinton team. And at the end of weeks and weeks of briefing them, this is how the domestic office works. This is how the foreign policy office works. This is how the numbers people work. After all of that, the exhausted Clinton people asked her, what is the single most difficult thing at the White House? And that was her answer. If you can pull off an Easter egg roll, you can do anything.
Why is it so difficult?
Because
just a bunch
when
of kids
we did
on the White
it,
House
it was an
lawn.
Event for 30,000 people on the South Lawn of the White House from about 9 in the morning until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. That's a lot of people to move through with stages and activities and celebrities. And my favorite one was the last one we did because we got Robert De Niro to read children's stories.
Oh my God. You're talking to me?
Well, at the time, he has twins, and they were toddlers.
Okay.
So he was perfect.
So were you involved in the pardoning of the Thanksgiving turkeys?
The turkey pardoning I was involved in. I will encourage your listeners to watch next time very carefully. If you watch the turkey pardoning and you listen, you may be able to hear that off in the distance, there's another turkey gobble, gobble, gobbling, because apparently the turkey pardoning is so stressful on the turkey that there's a more or less even chance that the specific turkey may keel over unconscious or even dead from the stress of being with the president in the Rose Garden. And so that would be an extremely unfortunate photo, president and a dead turkey. So the turkey grower who's been chosen that year, the producer, has to bring not one but two enormous turkeys, and the backup turkey is in a van on the south driveway.
There's an understudy for the turkey.
Yes, an understudy. That's exactly the word.
Now, our listeners may recall, because I had vague memories of this, that while President Clinton was in the White House, he had his 25th anniversary Georgetown University reunion of his class, which was also your class. Because he had made a promise to that class that when the 25th anniversary rolled around, he would have the reunion at his house. Well, lo and behold, he was living in the White House at that time. Did you arrange for that, the whole shindig?
Oh, I worked very hard on that dinner, and it was, at that point, the largest dinner that they had at the White House. It was 1,700 people, because you may send out invitations to your high school or college reunion, and maybe there's some participation and people will come, but when the invitation is to come to dinner at the White House,
Everybody comes.
A very high level of participation.
It's one would think.
So it was a fabulous event.
You know, you're a very brave person. It strikes me for a number of reasons as I read through the book, but the biggest reason today, at least, is because you are brave enough to admit that you went to an inaugural ball in a red Bill Blass dress that you picked up at a thrift shop.
Oh, I'm a very thrifty shopper.
Yes, but to put that in print.
Well, sometimes people will ask me, when I do my presentations, I have all these slides, and you can see me in a beautiful suit or an evening gown or whatever, and sometimes people will ask me if I got a clothing allowance, which is a hysterically funny question for me, because no, I got a decent salary but no clothing allowance, but you always had to look professional and nice, and I worked on many social events, receptions, state dinners, all kinds of things where I needed to look a certain way.
And meeting kings and queens and ambassadors.
That's right.
So you have to have a wardrobe.
So you have to have a wardrobe. But I'm a Washington native, so I knew where to shop.
Okay. You were at the White House for the whole Clinton administration, except for the first day, perhaps. But you were there for the whole 8 years. And that 8 years, of course, included the turmoil surrounding the Ken Starr investigation. Oh, is that what they're called in the White House?
The Troubles. Yes.
And the Monica Lewinsky situation. What did all of that do to morale, to the day-by-day working atmosphere of the White House among the people who were peers of yours, and not the president and first lady, just the people around them?
It was devastating. We were shocked. We were heartbroken.
Were you worried that it might be true?
So disappointed. Well, you know, for a whole year, I actually believed him for that year. I know Hillary believed him. I believed him because it was incomprehensible to me that he would be so reckless. I just couldn't conceive of it.
It remains incomprehensible. So how, when you found out that it was true, how did you feel?
I felt betrayed. I thought about how hard all of us had worked, set aside what he'd done to his family, but how hard all the rest of us had worked to get him to the White House, to move his agenda forward, to work on behalf of the American people. We weren't there for ourselves. We were there to do big things for the American people. And to put that in jeopardy was just incomprehensible. And I know that for quite a while, the president himself could not look people in the eye, and no one wanted to look him in the eye. He was so mortified, and we were just devastated by it. It took a long time to get over.
It wasn't just the Monica Lewinsky situation with I did not have sex with that woman in the blue dress, but it was also the Ken Starr investigation. For those who don't remember, and although I think everybody does, the special prosecutor Kenneth Starr, you say, had been hounding the Clintons for years, and you say in capital letters in the book, everything was political.
Everything.
And you further say that it still goes on, supported by your... And I'm going to quote you here, supported by your lazy-ass mainstream press who love nothing better than to regularly trot out the Clinton scandals. But I thought the mainstream press was liberal.
I think that that's – a lot of people think that, and I probably their personal political leanings are that way. But I think that when it comes to press coverage and stories, what the press wants is conflict, confrontation, and scandal, because those things sell newspapers, if anyone still buys a newspaper, sell airtime. People – they have a need to be the person who has discovered some hitherto unknown
– But isn't it their job to do that?
Sure. Yes, it is in some ways, but it's not their job to make scandals where none exist. So, for example,
but was it the media making that scandal, or was it Kenneth Starr making the scandal where there was no there there?
Well, Mr. Starr's attorneys were perfectly happy to leak what should have been protected and private testimony to grand juries, should have been very private. They leaked that regularly. And then that uncorroborated, those allegations would then show up on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times. And then months later, when it was proven that those things had not taken place or that the Clintons had not done something wrong, that information would show up on page A32 of the Saturday paper that nobody reads. So people knew all about the accusations, but they mostly didn't know that they were found not to have been guilty of anything related to Whitewater. And by the way, Whitewater was a failed land deal that happened, what, 10, 15 years before they came to the White House?
On which they lost money.
On which they lost money. So what possible interest could the government in the 1990s have had in this land deal?
And that's why you say everything is political.
Exactly.
So what do you make of the situation with Hillary Clinton and her email server? Is that political? Is that
–
or is there a there there?
I think it's absolutely –
I mean, why would she do that? Because you know this woman personally and you know the Clintons personally. Why would – A person who's been around the White House for 8 years, who was a governor's wife, who was a United States senator, who became the Secretary of State, use a personal email server in her home as opposed to using the government email servers for her email? I don't understand that.
I think probably for two reasons. One is Hillary is an intensely private person and has always believed that there should be some small zone of privacy that even a public person is entitled to. We can argue about whether that's true or not, but I know that that's very important to her.
Okay.
So there's that, and then there also was the convenience angle. Now, as she just said last week, in retrospect, did it turn out to have been convenient? No, not at all. But also in retrospect, we have governors like Governor Jeb Bush and Governor Jindal and Governor Walker and others who also have personal email accounts and have not turned over the emails from those accounts the way Hillary has done, 55,000 emails that she has turned over. The State Department has clearly announced that there was what she did was not against their rules in any way. She did not break any rules or violate any law. There's no criminal investigation, although the New York Times said there was. They were completely wrong. So ask yourself, is it political or is it not? I have my view. I think it's substantiated by facts.
How do you feel about Hillary? You knew that President Clinton was going to be something special when you met him on that first day at Georgetown. How do you feel about Hillary Clinton?
I adore Hillary Clinton. She's a woman that if you knew her, you would be so thrilled to have her as your friend.
I got to tell you, I met her, and I told you this in the break. I met her at a Barbra Streisand concert at the Cap Center in Washington, and at the intermission, there was a line of Secret Service and ushers that had linked hands to block, because the entire administration was there. All the muckety-mucks were there.
I remember
in the front
that
row.
Concert.
Well, they were linking hands, and I had a blue suit and a red, white, and blue tie on with a white shirt at a concert. And I walked down, and I told my friends, I'm going to walk down and meet the president. And they said, no, you're not. You're going to get flattened to the floor, and they're going to kick you out. I walked down to the ushers. They separated their hands. I walked through them, and I walked directly up to Mrs. Clinton. And we spent most of the intermission talking. And then she said, excuse me, I have to go talk to somebody else. And I said, great, thank you, nice to meet you. And she walks off. And then I'm looking around for somebody else to meet, or maybe Janet Reno. And she comes back, and she talks some more to me. And I thought, wow, she doesn't know who I am from Adam's house cat, and she's talking to me. And then the president walked up, and he gave me a look that if looks could kill, I would be dead.
That doesn't sound like
it. No, he was like, who are you, and why are you here? I quickly dismissed myself. But just the fact that she would talk to somebody like that, kind of impressive.
She's devoted her life to making people's lives better, especially women and children.
You start your book on the last day of the Clinton administration, on which he and the staff, and yourself included, were exhausted. And he was known for being tireless and for being a policy wonk and knowing the ins and outs of everything and demanding, I guess, that information from staff all through the 8 years. Did the staff have of trouble keeping up with him?
Oh, absolutely. The Clintons wear out teams of people. I used to say people half their age. Now it's people not even half their age. They just wear them out. It's an exhausting, stressful, difficult thing to do to work for the Clintons. It is an honor. It's a privilege. It's the most exciting thing you'll ever do. But my goodness, you end up exhausted.
Could the same be said for any president, though?
No, I don't think so, because I think some presidents live a quieter, more orderly life. So, and I mean that in a good way, because I think that George W. Bush and Mrs. Laura Bush, for example, lead very orderly lives. Mm-hmm. They're always on time for everything. Mm-hmm. Bill is never on time for anything. They are early to bed. If they say they're going to do something in a certain way at a certain time, that's the plan, and they follow that plan. The Clintons are completely unlike that. You could work for a month to arrange something that you think is going to be brilliant and successful and that they'll love, and that morning someone will come and say, the president has changed his mind and you're going to have to do something completely different. Wow. We'll throw all the plans away and start again.
We only have 30 seconds left, but I want to make sure that you're not arrested as you leave the room, because as you left the White House, you defaced it.
I did.
You used a Sharpie, and you put your name and your title and the years that you served, I guess, above a door jamb?
On the top of a door where no one would ever see it, but it would be there. And they were doors that I had brought to the White House. I had provided them for my office, so I felt entitled to do that.
Melinda Bates, she'll tell more stories about people and celebrities and dignitaries who came to the White House when she talks at the Southern Women's Show on Friday and Saturday at the Charlotte Convention Center. Her book is called White House Story, a Democratic Memoir. Thanks for sharing some of your memories. Appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Very welcome. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Charlotte's Graduate Certificate in Health Informatics, a program for working professionals, now accepting applications for spring 2016. Details at hi.uncc.edu. Abortion opponents are seeking details on women who get abortions and the doctors who perform them. Several states have moved to cut Planned Parenthood funding, even for clinics without abortion services. And on the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 o'clock, they'll talk about new tactics in the anti-abortion movement. That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, actually, we're going to be talking about something completely different now. We're going to be talking about late summer, early fall books for adults and for children. And if you'd like to put in your own suggestions, you can do so. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Oscar was a 1996 black S10 with a cap on the back.
We hauled everything in that
truck.
We
hauled everything.
We hauled mulch and soil and camping equipment.
Many kids moving apartment to apartment. It was a beautiful little truck, and it went to a beautiful cause.
My name's Pam Henry.
My name's Chris Henry, and we donated a Chevy S10 to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks for your support.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We have links to Melinda Bates' book, White House Story, A Democratic Memoir, on our website. And we're going to have links to all the things we're about to talk about. In a world of technology, it's nice to know that something particularly as low-tech as a book still has a place in our lives. Just as we catch you up on film from time to time, we're going to do the same things with books. And here to populate your late summer, early fall reading list is Sally Brewster, avid reader and owner of Park Road Books. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be back.
And we're going to have links. We may not get to all of the books that you have brought, but we will have information and links about all of the books that you intend to talk about on our website at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Now, I ask the movie critics this when they come here, and so I'm going to ask you this. How has it been this year in the world of books, for publishing, for writers, for the material they're providing booksellers and book readers, and for booksellers in general?
Well, I have to say we're a little loose this year. Last year was very strong. This year, especially this summer, tend to get it was taken over by Harper Lee's new book. I think a lot of other books were.
Well, I noticed that the new Harper Lee book is not among the books that you've brought in here. Is that because of how she treats Atticus Finch in the new book, which is a prequel to A Kill a Mockingbird, or is it because it's just not a good book?
I don't think it's a good book. It's the first draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, and I had issues of how the book came out. So issues. I have actually not read it.
Oh.
Nobody at the bookstore has read it.
Why not?
We feel like it's a first draft of a novel. A wonderful editor told Harper Lee where to go with the book, and she did. And
does it surprise you all the controversy surrounding it and the fact that people are so disappointed that Atticus Finch is a racist in the prequel?
I am amazed. She wrote it in the 50s. It's set in Alabama. Harper Lee's father was a product of the Reconstruction. I think people, especially since the movie came out, they tend to think of him as a real person, where he's just a made-up character.
Mm-hmm. And this, I think this is interesting, even if it's a first draft and not particularly good, and the editor said, you know, this could be better, rewrite it. And she did, and she had this major hit book on her hands. That shows you process.
I think she was taken advantage of.
I do.
I really do. 1 month after her sister dies, a new lawyer discovers a book, and I've never heard of a book not being edited. This is the only book that I've heard about in my entire career in the book industry that has not been edited.
But if you're looking at it from the point of view of this is history, this is how something began, this is a manuscript and how it began, isn't that interesting in and of itself?
I think so, and I think millions of people found that interesting. I just am not one of those people.
Well, okay. Let's talk about the books you brought to talk about here.
Wonderful.
We're going to begin with an adult book, Our Souls at Night by Kent, is it Harif?
Uh-huh.
It's a story of an older man and woman wrestling with their futures, and it takes place, as all of his novels evidently do, in Holt, Colorado. That's not a real place.
It is not a real place.
What makes Souls at Night special, deserving of being on your list?
It is beautiful. It is so beautifully written. It is the last book that Kent wrote. Unfortunately, he passed away this summer. And it is a beautiful love story about two people in their 70s. And it's just heart-wrenching.
And the publisher says this is the perfect final installment. That's what you expect the publisher to say. Perfect final installment to this writer's enduring contribution to American literature. You agree with that?
Absolutely. Any of his books are marvelous.
And they're trying to find their way in their later years by reinventing themselves? Is that essentially it?
They're looking for closeness. There are two people in their 70s. He's lost his wife. She's lost her husband. And
known each other for years, and they live in a small town.
They've known each other, and they decide that nighttime's the loneliest time, and they decide to sleep together. It's not about the sex. It's about the intimacy and comfort.
Hmm. Moving on to a children's book. That was a great segue. The Day the Crayons Came Home by Drew Daywald. This is for younger children.
It is for your youngsters. It is so funny. It's hilarious. It's the sequel to The Day the Crayons Quit. And it's about the crayons that get lost. The one that gets lost in the couch and is broken because dad sits on it. And it's about the crayon that got lost on vacation. And it's just a wonderful, beautifully illustrated book that'll make you and your children laugh.
And these crayons, the protagonist is a kid named Duncan, who is evidently a prolific crayon rescuer. They have to be rescued because why? Because they get lost in the couch cushions or what?
Right. Well, in the first book, they quit because they're overused. He colors too much. And so this one are the crayons that disappeared, and he's got to help them also. So, yes, he is the crayon rescuer.
And this is for ages what?
I would say 2 to 8. Honestly, even an 8-year-old will find it hilariously funny.
You have it with you?
I do. And it's beautifully illustrated.
With crayon drawings.
With crayons. You have the neon red crayon, so you do have some glow-in-the-dark action. You have some postcards because neon red gets lost on vacation, uh-huh, and she's got to make her way home. The purple crayon is a jumbo crayon that has been misused by his younger brother, and he just wants to be rescued.
Uh-huh.
They're just adorable. The turquoise one gets melted to the stinky sock, and he is not happy about this. Not happy at all.
So that's for kids. The Cartel is another adult recommendation by Don Winslow, and who's another best-selling author, ripped from the headlines about the Mexican-American drug wars.
Yes, this book came out early in the summer, and then right after that, we had the famous Kingpin escape from prison.
Right.
Which actually happens in the book.
It's really?
Amazing.
So
yes.
He's prescient.
He is. He is. This is the sequel to Power of the Dog, about an agent who goes after the drug kingpin, manages to put him away, loses everything in the meanwhile. So he goes off to a monastery to raise bees, and he finds out that the kingpin escapes from prison. Ripped from the headlines.
Wow. Obviously a good book. You're recommending it.
Superb book.
Page-turner?
Page-turner.
Can't put it down?
Page-turner. You should read Power of the Dog first.
Okay.
It won't ruin it if you read The Cartel by itself, but Don Winslow is such a fantastic writer. Any of his books will please.
Okay. Here's a book that could be confused with a child's book, but it's not. It's in the adult category. Pirate Hunters by Robert Kersen. It's an adventure mystery about two men willing to risk everything to find a sunken ship, the Golden Fleece.
The Golden Fleece. Joseph Bannister should have been known as the pirate to fear, bigger than Blackbeard, bigger than Captain Kidd, but he was lost to history. So the two Johns go out researching Joseph Bannister, who actually started off as a merchant. He made his way up through the Navy. Got to a point in his career and decided that he'd played it safe all his life and it was time to become a pirate and make the big money. And what happens is they research him, they find out where he's gone, they have to think like a pirate, and they go to the Dominican Republic and they find the treasure in the ship.
When I was reading about this book, somewhere I read that finding pirate ships. Not many people have found pirate ships. Is that true or is that part of the novel?
Well, it's actually nonfiction.
Oh.
So this is absolutely a true book, and there are not many pirate ships out there. Robert Kersen is a great storyteller. You will feel like you are reading fiction, but you are reading nonfiction.
Well, when I read the description of it, I thought it was fiction because it's so out there.
It's so outrageous. Yeah. I mean, everything just fell into place, and it's a great read.
See, truth is stranger than fiction after all. Meanwhile, back in the children's category, you're recommending Book Scavenger by Jennifer Burtman for tweens and young teens about 12 years old and in that area. It involves the creator of a game, and gosh knows, kids are into electronic games.
Absolutely. But the wonderful thing about this game is you go to find books, actual books. And it takes place in San Francisco. It is a great, wonderful adventure that is based around Edgar Allan Poe's The Gold Bug. And it is just so much fun. It's great for a little bit of history. It intermingles the fun of the internet with the wonderfulness of books.
And she's obviously talking to kids who use the internet, who play these electronic games, but are those the kids who read books?
Yes, I do believe so. I think kids nowadays they're up for anything and everything.
Hmm. How do you, because you brought five children's books, mm-hmm. how do you as an adult gauge a good children's book? How do you know it's a good children's book or a children's book that children will think is a good book?
Well, I ask the kids in the store. I mean, that's, you know, firsthand sources. You know, we see them. They come in almost daily sometimes. They sit on the couch. They pick up the book. They start reading. And I love to talk about books. So we'll just go back and forth. And I'll ask them, why did you like this? And it goes from there.
Are there as many kids in your bookstore reading books today as there were? I don't know how long you've been at Park Road Books. But you've been there a long time.
Long time.
Is it the same number of kids?
I think it's more. I am really thrilled to say that I think that more kids are reading now. And I put that on Harry Potter. I think Harry Potter opened up a huge world and reminded kids that reading is fun and you don't need to be afraid of big books.
Do they want the book or do they want to read it on their Kindle?
We see a lot of kids that actually read it on the iPad or the Kindle, and then they come back in because they want to own it. They want it on the shelf. It's like their friend. They can look over, look at the spine, and smile and think what a good time they had reading it.
Are you sure they're not baby boomers? Because it seems to me that's what we want. We want to hold the physical, we want to hold the record album or the CD or the book in our hand and put it on the shelf, and there it is forever. Whereas today, everybody's just downloading these ephemeral, not really there things that live in the cloud someplace.
Live in the cloud. I think we do need some reminders, you know.
Okay. Here's another adult book. And you look at the title and you think, maybe not, but it is. My Grandmother Asked Me to Tell You She's Sorry by Frederick Backman, also about a 7-year-old girl, and she's kind of different, as is her 77-year-old grandmother, who is described as being crazy. This is essentially about the right to be different.
It is about the right to be different, and it's a perfectly charming book. Elsa and her grandmother are very close, very strong. You find out that her grandmother is a medical doctor and has been all over the world helping to save kids and people in situations, and the grandmother passes away suddenly. And she has left Elsa letters. And it is her job to go deliver these letters. And she finds out that the people she delivers the letters to are actually part of a story that her grandmother has been telling her for years and years.
Wow, she's leaving a seven-year-old child to deliver letters after she's died.
Elsa is a very smart young lady. I think we underestimate kids.
Okay. The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan is the last book, I think, on your adult reading list. And it deals with an American girl at Oxford who becomes involved with a student down the hall. Who is that student?
That student is the heir to the throne of England. And this book is a wonderful guilty pleasure based on Kate Middleton and her romance.
Well, I was going to ask about that.
Absolutely.
Because there's a brother involved in this, too, who's also of the royal family. And he's described as kind of a scamp, in a way. That's kind of like the royal family.
It is shamelessly ripped off. It's about the pressure that you are when you're under the spotlight, when you are the super celebrity. It is just so much fun. You start the book off, you're knowing that she's going to marry the prince. And but there's some things that she's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And it's just delicious.
Really?
It is so much fun.
And it is about the difficulties of living in that never-ending, always-on bright spotlight.
Yes, and the lengths you go to, being rolled up in a carpet and being put in the back of a car.
Are some of those actually from real things?
Well, supposedly they are. You know, just think of the lengths you'd have to go through if you had to date the most famous person in the Western Hemisphere.
Wow. Back to kids' books, Serafina and the Black Cloak by Robert Beatty. Is it Beatty or Beatty? Which involves a girl, Serafina, who has never had a reason to venture beyond the grounds of the Biltmore Estate. Our Biltmore Estate?
Our
National?
Biltmore Estate.
Is this a North Carolina author, or is this?
Yes, he lives in Asheville. Right. It is set at the Biltmore Estate when the Vanderbilts are actually there. It's 1899, and Serafina is the rat catcher. Her father runs the estate, and it's her job at night to catch the rats. And one night, she sees a gentleman in a dark cloak put the cloak around a young girl, and then the girl disappears. And Serafina is determined that he is not going to get any more children, and if she's going to do something about it with one of the Vanderbilt boys. And it's a great adventure.
Okay. Two more children's books before we run out of time here. Jacoby by William Ritter and The Wrath and the Dawn by Renee Adie. Is that how you say her name?
Adia.
Mm-hmm. Adia. Wrath is for teens. Jacoby is for age 12 and up. Takes place in New England, Jacoby does, where a serial killer is on the loose.
Yes. And this is Sherlock Holmes meets Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So it is a lot of fun. There's a lot of mysterious things going on. The sequel is just coming out. The sequel is just as wonderful as the first one. It's very atmospheric. I've had plenty of adults read it and be very fond of it.
And The Wrath of The Wrath and the Dawn is the story about each day bringing horror to a different family in a land ruled by a killer. The killer is Khalid, the 18-year-old caliph of Khorasan, who takes a new bride every night, only to have her executed at sunrise. This book is for teenagers?
This book is for teenagers, and Renee is actually a charlatan. So this is one of our Charlotte authors, and it is wonderful. It is based on 1,000 Nights, Tales of Scheherazade, and the main character willingly gives herself up after her best friend is killed by the caliph. And she manages to last not one, not two, but multiple nights. And you find out why she starts to feel differently about the monster.
He being the monster.
He being the monster.
All of the books that we've talked about here are on our website. So if you didn't take copious notes, you can get them on our website here at WFAE.org, Charlotte Talks. Sally Brewster is the owner of Park Road Books, which I think is the longest operating, most successful locally owned bookstore.
It is, 1977. Hooray.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us again. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7.